Welcome to Stories for Hope, where we're going to talk about mental health, mental illness, and suicide. And we're going to challenge the stigma that prevents people from getting the help that they need. Join us as we take a journey with those that have struggled. What did they learn about themselves and others during that time? And what was helpful and what got in the way as they gained their resiliency? Join us and let's learn together. These are Stories for Hope, and I'm your host, Cecilia Marie Roberts. Michelle Peak is the founder and executive director of Art Not Shame, a Guelph not-for-profit that works to foster community connection through facilitated multidisciplinary art-making workshops and co-learning opportunities. They've engaged 5,600 individuals, wow, through workshops and events, and employed 30 unique professional artists to do it, and also, you know, have partnered with 39 community partners. I invited Michelle to Stories for Hope to really talk about art and how it builds community. So welcome, Michelle, and thanks for being here with me.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So, Michelle, I really want to talk about the meaning and the importance of community. And I watched a short video on your website when I was preparing to sit down and have a chat. And the video was really talking about the James Peak Memorial Golf Tournament that you and your family started in memory of your brother that died by suicide. In the video, you said something that really resonated with me, that the community that emerged after James's death probably saved our lives. Mm-hmm. So can you tell us a little bit about that?
There are so many things that I'd want to say about that. One, I think just purely from the standpoint of having the incredible privilege to have permission to talk about our loss. Like we had, I mean, this was not our intent. This was just sort of a beautiful unintended impact of coming together to do something so public, is that it's not a secret. It's not hidden. And that was definitely intentional. My mom was very adamant that we talk and that we talk about this and that we not sweep it under the rug. But what that enabled for us as a family is like dedicated space and time to be in community and be in public in our grief in ways that were hard, but also incredibly permission giving. I cannot tell you what it's like to look out at like literally hundreds of people who are there just like holding space for you. Because we would do this yearly address, started off with my dad. Eventually I ended up taking part of it as well. And it was incredible. I felt really, really held and felt like this is certainly a privilege and an honor to be held by that many people. And it also meant that we as a family talked about it every year at the same time, for better or worse.
And I know you and I have talked about holding space so much, and in so much of the work that we do in suicide prevention, we hear from people who've been impacted. And yes, it could be about suicide, but really it's about anything that we've really struggled with. The gift that another person can give us by holding space for our story, by honoring it, by just, you know, I mean, you use the word permission, which I think is interesting, but really just being there and bearing witness to it.
Yeah, being with it.
Yeah.
Yeah, it felt very much like a being with. It was pretty incredible to have that many people sit with us in our grief without judgment or needing to fix us or shame or anything like that.
I know I said this, I think, in one of the earlier podcasts around the notion that in many instances, people struggle to know what to say or the fear of saying something wrong or something inappropriate. And I'm always constantly saying, but really you don't need to say anything. You just need to listen.
Yeah.
And you need to be genuinely curious and open about anything that you hear. I think this created this foundation of the importance of community for you. And you seem to then have turned that into something that led you into sort of using art to create community. So I'm curious about how it kind of evolved, how Art Not Shame evolved, and how did you come up with that name?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, what you said there, like two things sort of stick out to me, like having someone bear witness to and hold space for your grief is huge and does not take as much as we think it does. It doesn't require needing to know the right thing to say or like really literally just being with someone. So that that has stayed with me and I think is just has found expression in other parts of my life. In my schooling, I pursued English and culture studies. So, you know, the value of storytelling, which requires sort of a teller and a listener and a being with someone in their life or bearing witness to a person's life. So I think this whole notion of, yeah, bearing witness to and holding space for another and how that can be transformative for both people has been like a key theme in my life. And keeping in mind too that I lost my brother when I was 15. So, and by the time I founded Art Not Shame in 2017, I can never remember how old I am. A few years ago, I'm in my late 30s.
She was 19.
yeah. So during that time, I was also witnessing, like I was both in the system as someone who then struggled with their own mental health after this incredible, like devastating loss, and also someone who was, you know, trying to, even though when I was young, sort of in a not as involved way as I do now, but trying to also create some kind of change. So I was also witnessing some of the gaps. And for me, I think I remember even as young as 15 thinking like my brother dying by suicide was more than just one thing. There was, you know, component. I would imagine there are components of depression. There are components of wrong time, wrong place kind of thing. But also, you know, the fact that he didn't feel like he could speak out, and that seemed to me bigger than a biomedical model of mental health might be able to hold. So even at 15, I was thinking like, there's more to this story in terms of what makes us well and what makes us unwell and what makes us able to speak openly and not able to speak openly.
You know, what a wise observation that was for you. But I mean, I've come to know you now over a couple of years, and I think you think deeply, and it's your way to think deeply about things. So in a way, it doesn't surprise me, but I still think it's incredibly wise for a 15-year-old to be making that.
Well, I think also because I said I went through the system, you know, I had my own struggles afterwards, like I could feel it on a bodily level. I could feel the gaps in, you know, in sitting in a psychiatrist's office and being diagnosed in a matter of 15 minutes and feeling like there's something else here. Like there has to be more to this. So as I sort of grew up and matured and explored other kinds of avenues and interests, I discovered just how powerful the language of storytelling is, and that it doesn't always have to happen through words. And that both storytelling and art making engage us in that process of holding space and witnessing one another in really powerful ways. So I have a very specific story of how the name Art Not Shame came about. A couple things were happening. I was working as an artist facilitator, assisting with digital storytelling projects. And again, this like theme of witnessing and holding space for other people was really present in my life. And I was also helping. Someone had approached me to do a photo shoot for them, a nude photo shoot for them, because she had, you know, struggled her whole life with it, with ideas of her body, like imposed by society and others, and really wanted to reclaim a sense of, I guess, agency and be able to define for herself. And so I had also been working as a photographer. And so we did this really neat shoot where I tethered to a screen, an external monitor, so that she could direct her own shoot, as opposed to like this traditional dynamic of a photographer with like, which honestly typically male and has sort of all the power and is framing the female body in sort of stereotypically desirable ways or objectifying the female body. And so we just sort of flipped that dynamic. And I remember thinking like, holy crap, we're making like art, not shame. Like we're flipping that whole concept of the female body being, you know, first objectified and then being made into a source of shame and reclaiming it as a space of art that is self-defined. So that also was, I was quite literally playing with the concept of what would it mean to take concepts or spaces or things in our lives that make us feel shame and transform them into art. And that is something that lots of artists do. Like that's certainly not like I didn't invent that by any stretch. But that name just kind of stuck.
I think it's powerful in and of itself. I mean, I know the first time I heard it, I thought, oh, wow, that's thought provoking for me.
Yeah.
The non-artist, you know, barely can, you know, I don't have a lot of experience with any form of art, really. Maybe
I would argue you're still creative.
Thanks for that, Michelle.
Everyone is.
I appreciate that.
One of my favorite people in life, Nadia Cheney, we were having this conversation about like, what's the difference between art, capital R A art, or artists or professional art, and like creativity. And she said, well, like every day the world creates, and we are part of that world. And so it is part of our birthright to create every day anew and again. And that to me, like when I almost wish it could be called like creativity, not shame, like, because I think a lot of people have a lot of, like, they attach a lot of preconceived notions about art or being artistic to the word art.
Yes.
And I think what we actually mean to get at is like
expression.
Yeah, we all have the capacity to create. You create when you get dressed, you create when you make a meal, like, you know what I mean? And so
I totally agree. It's interesting because I remember when I was in university, I'd lived, you know, there was a bunch of us lived in a house, and, you know, we were all really close, and there was this one girl who was just ridiculously talented and very artistic, and I remember having this exact same conversation. Well, I'm not artistic, and she just like whipped around and she said, Sam, you're artistic, like, you have your own style, like the way that you dress is so CM, and that's artistic. And that stuck with me. Like, that was, you know, many years ago. So I agree. We all have the capacity
I like your roommate.
For artistic expression. And I think it comes back to expression. And, you know, these talks are all about that and the power of expression and what it does. You know, I have someone who I love dearly who really struggles with her mental health. And she has always been artistic. And it's interesting to me because much of her art has come through like craft type art. And she's always giving that, creating it and giving it and creating it and giving it. And it's almost like there's as much joy in the creating as there is in the giving, you know? And she never really wants to hold on to anything she creates. I find that so fascinating.
That is really cool.
You know, she's painting right now, and it's actually the first time that I've noticed that she's putting those up on her wall and enjoying them. And I've often thought, wow, this is an interesting shift for you. And you're now able to kind of, you know, have those and enjoy them yourself. Mm-hmm. And the need to give them, or the desire to give them, seems to have shifted, which I find kind of interesting.
Super interesting.
I know. Mm-hmm. I find it interesting mm-hmm. too. Another day, another podcast, yeah. Right? So one area that I kind of want to talk a little bit about is, and you kind of touched on it when you mentioned sort of the biomedical model, or mm-hmm. or when we talk about struggle, or we use sort of scientific diagnoses and interventions and assessments and everything to support people. But for many people, they struggle to tell their story, to understand their story, to understand what's happening to them and articulate that. And art seems to be another way to get at those important core threads inside that are mm-hmm. that are maybe becoming unraveled for them, or, you know, needing to be understood more deeply. And art seems to do that for them. And I know that you have a program that, you know, we at the Canadian Mental Health Association have supported called Fuck Perfect. And it's really focused on kind of exploring how to take the power away from perfectionism, this idea that, you know, shows up in our lives and is part of society and culture, but is often a really mm-hmm. big theme for folks that struggle. So can you tell me a little bit about that program and how you do that and who shows up for it? And
yeah, and if it's okay with you, I want to circle back to what you said about art giving us access to other parts of ourselves. So I did some of my studies looking at, and this is something that has just fascinated me my whole life, and maybe this explains a lot about why I am where I am, about like what makes up the human. And so if we like think about where we are in the world in this moment, and I'm saying we, but I'm really talking from my very particular space here in, like, you know, a Western world view, we are so separated in so many ways from each other, from nature, from our body, from our feelings. And there's like good historical, without getting super boring and academic, but it's like there's reason for that. Like we have been brought up in a way of thinking that values, for example, logic over feeling, or values linearity over circularity, or
individualism
over, yeah, collectivism, all of those things. So art to me is like a way, and this is connected to even much broader narratives, right? Like narratives of systemic racism, of sexism, of, like, you know, the demands of capitalism on our body. Like all of these things sort of ask of us that we push down parts of ourselves, in my opinion. And so art for me is about getting back into the body, getting back into feeling. And it's not the only way to do that, but when I'm in a creative process, not in a process to create a product to sell or to be finished or to be perfect, but when I'm just in process and I'm giving myself permission to be in my body, to be in my feelings, this sounds so cheesy, but I feel more whole. I feel more human. And I feel more connected to myself. I feel more connected to others. I feel more connected to the world. So that was a long way of setting up a program like Fuck Perfect, is thinking about like, where does this pressure to be perfect come from? What systems does it feed and benefit that are not of our creation, or that are of our creation, but not maybe of our consent? And how does that pervade all aspects of our lives? So, and I should just preface by saying, different facilitators will take this up differently. So this is my take. And right now we have a beautiful team of facilitators running Fuck Perfect. So they may have something totally different and wonderful to say. But for me, I would approach it from what's called like the four I's, like the individual, interpersonal, ideological, and institutional, which is just a really fancy way of saying, how does perfectionism show up in the self? How does it show up between us? How does it show up in our ideas? And how does it show up in systems? And then how can we push back against those things? And so rather than, you know, write an essay or have like just a dialogue, not just a dialogue, but just like keep it in the realm of like the brain and the head and thinking, we engage those questions through art process. So we might set up an activity that like is intentionally meant for you to quote unquote fail and then have a conversation about it, or like draw or paint with our non-dominant hand, or ask questions like, what would it be like to do this without X, Y, or Z expectation in the way, and then be in that process together and then come together and kind of debrief, talk, and sort of hold each other in this. And the other piece that we do in Fuck Perfect that I think is equally important to using the arts and the expressive arts to get at these questions is we set up a very particular container, which is, you know, asking people what they need, like coming from like a disability justice standpoint, like assuming that we all have needs and they're not all the same. And sometimes they're in conflict with one another and sometimes they change, but that I think part of perfectionism is this feeling that like there's like a compulsory ableism, like you must be okay. You must not ask for help. You must be able to do everything. And of course that will privilege certain kinds of bodies. So if we set a container that's like, actually we all have needs and we're going to create the space and care here to be able to say those out loud and let them change and invite us, the group, to negotiate them together, is just not how things usually happen, right? Like it's just a different way of being in space with one another. And then simultaneously, like, what do you need, but also what do you bring? What are your strengths? And it's always so wonderful to see that take shape, like to see the group kind of come together around like witnessing, holding space, and making negotiations for and with each other's needs. But also like it also always makes me like want to cry. Like, I'm a really good listener and I'll be here to listen to you, and I'm this, and like it's just, yeah, it's a really beautiful space that I think works counter to a lot of, you know, workplaces and different spaces that people find themselves in.
You know, I'm curious, it sounds like an enormous job as a facilitator to do that work.
Yeah.
I can only imagine. But I also, you know, also can clearly see that it would be so rewarding. So do you have any stories, like help me to, or try and give me an example, if you can, mm-hmm. of someone who was transformed by, you know, by being given the gift of that space and had the opportunity to use art to discover and push back on perfectionism and maybe, you know, really... really kind of shifted.
Yeah.
Like, what were some of the good stories?
Oh, so many. I mean, I can think of two people who stand out for whatever reason who just like actually said like this changed their life. Like they went from, I think, feeling shame about their abilities to create or whatever to like just fully embracing their artistic side and writing songs and like just beautiful, beautiful transformation. And I think that was enabled by the community that held them. You know, it's not like it's not the program necessarily. It's like the community that held them. Another person I remember. So sometimes we do free writing exercises. And again, these are sometimes set up in a way so that there are parameters so people can't overthink things maybe, or like, you know,
that's the one I need to sign up.
Yeah.
For.
I mean, me too. I need it as much as anyone. Like I benefit from it too. Like trying to find ways to sort of quiet the voice that will say like, you can't do that, you're not good enough, whatever. So like if you have a timed free write, and this won't be accessible for everyone, but for those for whom it is, you say, you know, grammar doesn't matter, spelling doesn't matter, logic doesn't matter. It, like, you're really just trying to let flow, like, whatever is coming to you through your body, out your hand, onto the page, and you just don't stop. And then from there, we do like a series of, we like to call it like scaffolding risk. That's how we intentionally build in these like experiences within Fuck Perfect that gets people to go to their edge, not an unsafe edge, but a learning edge, and see what's possible. And so I remember one participant in particular came back the next week and was like, I discovered I'm a poet. And I'm just like, yeah, you are. And then, you know, other things that happen that, you know, no grant application is going to be able to track, but you see these like alliances forming, like, you know, one person coming in and bringing a trans flag and writing Fuck Perfect on the trans flag, and then another, you know, potential ally coming up and being like, what is that about? And then you hear about them going to a parade together, and like that there, this friendship has blossomed. And like, you know, I think the other thing that Fuck Perfect does is it tries, and we're always learning, like we do not have the answers here, but it tries to intentionally build community across difference, precisely because of what I said, where it's, you know, it's not just like, you know, a medical diagnosis that dictates how well we are, how much we feel like we belong in this world. It's also all of that other crap that we deal with around transphobia and racism and ableism. Like, those things also have to be held and addressed in order for us to feel like seen and belong.
It really reminds me a lot of what years ago, you know, when the kind of recovery movement started, and this notion that, you know, we, to be recovered is whatever it means to us. Mm. And it really is just about learning to live, learning mm-hmm. to, you know, identify the life that we want mm-hmm. and move towards it. Mm-hmm. And it is defined by us and created by us and lived by us, as opposed to this sort of notion that other people have about what being well or unwell is.
Absolutely.
And you know, we absolutely understand and value the role of peers, supporting peers mm-hmm. in across mental health and addiction system. And I think we are really only at the early stages of fully embracing and uncovering the power of that. And, yeah. and I would say locally, we have an enormous capacity around peer support, and we yeah. have many, many programs that people are engaging in. And I think, you know, this program almost feels like that on steroids, right? It's yes. it's taking people, but then it's just this other whole level of art in this openness to express and become aware together, and very well, powerful stuff.
I just want to say, like, the amount of care and knowledge from lived experience and like that I have been fortunate enough to witness in this program is incredible to me. Like, there is so much to learn from the participants who have been in these programs, who have had to navigate a lot of these things on their own without systemic support. I just find it every time I find I'm just surrounded by such incredibly caring, beautiful people who have found ways to be with one another without, like, exactly what you said, like, there's no progress narrative, there's no fixing or saving or endpoint. It's just like, how do we be with each other and know that, like, the other thing that we try to do that we've learned from various places, like Partners for Youth Empowerment is a place that we've been trained by, and Nadia Cheney again, is just like this strength-based model where it's like you assume that everybody is doing the best they can. You know, it doesn't mean we can't grow, it doesn't mean we're right, like those are different things. It's just everybody is doing the best that they can with what they've inherited, been given, found themselves in. And when you approach people that way, like, ironically, incredible transformation is possible, because you're not starting from a point of deficit.
Right.
It's like, you are welcome here as you are.
One of the other things that we've been talking about on this podcast was this notion of, you know, people that are struggling are somehow labeled as weak, you know,
this
social stigma that surrounds that. And quite frankly, for me, it's something that really gets under my skin, because I have, you know, in the many years that I've been doing this work, I've never met anyone who has struggled with significant mental health issues or has been touched by suicide that is weak. You know, they are brave, they are, you know, they're wise, you know, they're resilient, they're vulnerable, but they're not weak. And I think that this is a really important shift that needs to happen, you know, across society. And when we think about what we've all been through,
yeah,
you know, in the last 20 some months, is it 20 now? I don't know. I've lost track. I was actually doing a bit of a presentation yesterday, and we were focused on what some of the silver linings, if we can call them that, of the pandemic have been. And, you know, one of the things that I shared was, you know, this, the enormous shift, really monumentous shift in understanding and awareness of our own personal mental health that has taken place during this time. And I truly hope that will, you know, impact our thinking and our judgment and the stigma that's attached to what is just part of who we are, which is our struggle, right? It's part of that, one of those threads. And I really hope we'll see that it'll have a huge impact on stigma, and that people will, that will start to fall away, and people will start to feel safer to engage in conversation, to be the space, be that container for other people, and we'll reach out and understand that it's fine to struggle and it's fine to need help.
Yeah. Well, I think it's so human. And I think it's so interesting. As you said the word weak, I was like, so one of our principles, we have five principles. I'm for sure not going to remember them all, but starts with, we are all creative. And I think the second one is, we are all exactly who we need to be, but we don't all have what we need. So can you imagine if instead of weak, like when I think about it, like when a plant is weak, it just doesn't have what it needs, right? It just doesn't have enough sunlight or water or whatever. So like if a person is weak, like there's nothing in and of itself wrong with that, except for when it becomes a value judgment on someone's like individual will or something or worth, when in fact, like to be weak might just mean we don't have access to what we need. Likewise, like for me to have gone through what I've gone through and, you know, created an organization is because I'm incredibly privileged and had access to all of what I needed, right? And so it doesn't make me stronger. It means I have more access. And it also means that it's, you know, it's possible for everyone to thrive when they have what they need.
I think I'm going to end on that. I think that's... That's what we need to hear. We'll all be okay. Michelle, thanks so much. Clearly we're friends.
Yeah.
There's been far too much giggling going on to, you know, come to any other conclusion. So I really appreciate you coming in today. And, you know, Art Not Shame is a gem in this community.
Thank you. I know
it's in its infancy.
Thank you.
I can't wait to see what and how much it's going to create community as the years go by. So thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you. It was a real pleasure.
This has been a great conversation, but for some of you, it may have been a bit difficult. And if you find yourself having some emotions, I think it's important to acknowledge them. Maybe tell a trusted friend or a partner or even a professional and take some time to self-care. But if you really have been distressed or if it's triggered thoughts of suicide, we want you to get in touch with someone now. If you're here in Waterloo, Wellington, please call here 24/7 at 1-844-437-3247. And if you're anywhere else, the Canadian Suicide Prevention Services at 1-833-456-4566. Thanks for listening.